So the Dan Dan flow likes to explore consciousness. And a big part of exploring that is human stories and their knowledge and their insights and so on to help better understand other people and hopefully get to better understand ourselves through that. Today I have a very special guest, Jeremy Nell, a.k.a. Germ. Welcome to the Dan Dan flow.
Thanks, man. It's nice to be in the studio. Just saying to you a moment ago, there's a certain vibe when you're in person that you just cannot get when you record online.
No, I believe that's true. And obviously, you can't always do in person. Luckily, we get to do that today. I want a little bit of a preamble before we jump into it. I know you have all kinds of wild ideas and you're well known for talking about them. And I don't. Obviously, we can mention one or two along the way if that's necessary, but I actually want to explore your story, and I want to know what got you to the place where you would have this courage to confront a lot of the status quo stories and ideas. Now, at some point, obviously, you'll anger people with conspiracy theories and so on, where they might say, oh, you're picking the wrong side of this battle or whatever. And on some things, you might just seem ridiculous to most people. So, I think you originally, 2005, you started as a cartoonist, sort of self-taught cartoonist. What got you there? And what did that exploration teach you about pushing the envelope?
I've always loved drawing cartoons. I mean, I was drawing in my Bible in Sunday school. You know, they didn't like it, but...
But you did.
But I did, yeah. Because I found Sunday school quite boring, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm actually an apologist for Christianity, and I think it's intrinsically linked to sort of Western civilization. But I was nonetheless bored at Sunday school, so I drew a lot in my Bible, and then I drew in my textbooks at school, and I drew just anywhere and everywhere, and so. I don't know. I fell in love with what's largely considered the lowest form of art. I mean, cartooning is at the bottom of the hierarchy. You don't see cartoons in the Louvre being exhibited. And this was something that was spoken about by Charles Schulz in the 80s. I'm going on a segue here, but he drew Charlie Brown, and I think it was in 1985 or thereabouts in an interview, and he said, you know, cartoonists are sort of like the punk rockers of the art world. They are the guys who do the simplest creation and basically cheat the audience because they get away with so much with so little. But the reality is that it for me it's an expression. It's something that I love to see the results in. The most sort of complex ideas in the simplest way possible, and that led me to being bored of my cubicle job. I was in research and development, the sort of the tech sector, and that was just before smartphones came out.
So it's telecommunications.
Yes, yeah. But it was the era of the sort of the flip folding phones. They were color. You know, there was no Wi-Fi or anything like that yet connected to them, and they were, you know, they had buttons.
Yeah, SMSs, MMSs.
MMSs were the big one, yeah. MMSs, and you could SMS to a certain number, and it would send back, you know, tunes or remember that.
Yeah. You can get your ringtone.
That's right.
Or whatever else.
And then I drew cartoons on the side, and I started a website where I would publish my cartoons, and I just wanted to get a bit of an audience. And then I thought to myself, well, hang on. You know, if Madam and Eve can have a comic strip and Zapiro can be a political cartoonist, and maybe I can also. And I did study art at varsity, at UCT, but I failed. Like, I'm a varsity dropout, and one of the things I've always never been able to answer is, how do you fail art? Like, how does that even happen? Like, how can you fail art? It makes no sense.
Yeah, it's really a question to the institution and not one directed at you.
But I nonetheless failed art, and that was a message to, you know, not go into art. So what do? When you are anti-establishment to some degree, you go, well, thank you very much. I will do exactly the opposite, and I'll go into art and actually make a career out of it. And that's precisely what I did. And I found my way into the sort of the newspaper realm around 2005, as you pointed out. And then around 2007, I was drawing for The Times, which is now, I think, Times Live. It was this sort of online offshoot of the Sunday Times, and my editor contacted me and he said, listen, why don't you make some political comments?
I guess up until that point your cartoons hadn't been political. No, they'd just been like,
it was just typical comic strip type stuff,
milk and toast.
Yeah And he said, why don't you, you know, make some political commentary? And I said, I don't know what to say. I can't draw politicians, and I don't know where I stand politically. And he said, well, it's easy. You knock them down when they're up, and you help them up when they're down.
Amazing.
And I've never forgotten that. And it's a very sort of apolitical position, and I think it's a better position. I think it's a more powerful position to have. And anyway, so why am I telling you this? So this is all part of what formed where I am today. Because the journey took me down an incredible path of discovery in terms of how the system works, how society operates, what makes us tick. Do we have purpose? Why do we have purpose? What is our purpose? And why are we fighting? And things like, where are the failures? Where are the successes? Who's pulling the strings? And, you know, eventually you start having these sort of existential questions. Ultimately, that's what arises from political satire.
Because the political satire forces you to critique the systems that you actually live in.
Yes.
And when you critique them enough, you start to wonder, well,
exactly,
why the hell are we even here? How do we get here?
Yeah, exactly right. And so, but I realize that it's also a very dark and negative space. I constantly battle with, I won't say depression, but I'll say anxiety. What's the other one I'm looking for? Dark, like pessimism, nihilism. Very easy to fall into those traps, because remember, political satire is about ridiculing mediocrity. It's not about ridiculing excellence. You don't mock something or someone who's excellent. There's nothing to mock. That's precisely why you ridicule mediocrity, because you are wanting them to be better. So in other words, you're making fun of a politician or the president because you think that he's being mediocre or subpar.
Could do better.
If somebody's doing brilliantly, why would you make fun of them? It doesn't make sense. And then the sort of more sensitive areas, you don't really make fun of people who are, you know, on the dregs of society. You don't poke fun at a beggar. That's just unfair. That's like punching downwards.
Punching down, yeah.
Yeah, and it's also the same thing as running past an old lady who's sitting, you know, just in a park, and you start swearing at her, and then keep running and laughing. It's just not.
It's infantile.
Yeah, and it doesn't do anything, and it doesn't add value to anything. It just decreases your value, your input.
There's sort of essentially two directions. I know it's more complex than that, but essentially two vectors for society, you know, better or worse. You want to be part of the thing that drives it towards betterment.
Correct.
You don't want to be something that, you don't want to detract from the good in society.
But the problem is that where the anxiety / depression, nihilism, darkness can set in, it's because it's a perpetual subdivision of topics and issues, because you're always looking for mediocrity. So it doesn't matter if there is excellence, you're going to still find mediocrity, because it's an infinite loop. It's that intersectional nature of looking for satire, for commentary. So nobody can really ever succeed under those conditions. But that is the nature of the beast. And so it does lead, at least me, and I can certainly speak on behalf of many cartoonists, because I've been speaking to them for 20 years, all over the world. They all suffer from the same problem. They start becoming very angry.
So it's sort of asking, you know, can an art critic actually just enjoy art because of the art?
Well, by definition, no.
Because if your job is to criticize all the time, then, you know, that becomes your mindset. So you're just looking for the weakness the whole time.
Correct.
And I suppose what you're saying is, as a cartoonist, but also as a social commentator and podcast host and so on, you're looking for the things that are the weaknesses, and that obviously starts to cover most of your consciousness. Because yes. In your conscious awareness, if you're doing well, if you're having a great day, you with family and friends and laughing and everyone's happy, and you suddenly stop and think back about your life, chances are you remember all the great things. You think, isn't life amazing? If you're in a terrible place and you stop and think back, then you remember all the times that were terrible.
Mm.
Because you can't keep in mind everything that's happened to you in your whole life the whole time. So it's sort of the aperture that your mind uses to look back at your memory is defined by what you're currently busy with. And so what you're saying is, because you're spending so much time in the negative, it starts to feel like the whole world is just terrible.
That's correct. And so it's like it's a perma critique. It's never ending. And as a result, you know, you become angry just for no reason. You're just angry. Like everything just makes you angry. I constantly battle with that. And I know other cartoonists do. The good news, however, is that if you are able to hold up a mirror and you can be aware of these things, then of course that's a good thing. Cause then you can find ways to get around that. Yeah. Go away for weekends. Hang out with friends, go lie in the sun, walk in the, you know, whatever, doesn't matter. But just to break away from the cycle. And that, if I'm taking on along the journey, kind of took an interesting twist in 2019 when I decided, well, hold on, an extension of the ideas in my cartoon work is simply to talk about them with people. I mean, it's obvious, right? Because cartoons generate discussion. That's part of the nature of cartoons.
You're saying it's a form of art. It's a branch of fine art, and you have to say a lot with very little. But then why not just talk about
it? Yeah, because it's just merely an extension. Because somebody will look at your cartoon and they'll get outraged if they disagree with the comment, or they will laugh, and others will share it and that kind of thing, and you end up with people commenting all the time. So because it's about the idea. It's, you know, a political cartoon is kind of 60-70% idea and 30-40% drawing. You can sometimes just have almost no drawing on the page and make a comment. So it is about generating discourse. So talking with people about ideas suddenly occurred to me in 2019. And I thought, well, let's do that. You know, we can now. This is not 20 years ago. It was very difficult to do that. You can
put a tape recorder next to your handset.
Now you can technically just use YouTube, and you can live stream, and you can get people literally watching, commenting at the same time while you're talking to somebody. And they can talk back to you. It's amazing how that wasn't the case, you know, 20 years ago, and how easy it is now, and dirt cheap. You know, you basically just need Wi-Fi and a somewhat okay microphone and camera. And that's where it started. And that became the expanded collection of ideas that I was constantly toying with. I mean, I'm just wired all the time.
Like the Jeremy Metaverse.
Yeah, I'm just always wired. So I'm always thinking of why and how, you know, and you know, if I'm driving and I see, you know, clouds and I wonder, how like, how do they get there? You know, why are they floating? These are the obvious questions that you learn in school, but then you ask more questions and you go, like, what impact do they actually have on temperature? And you start, and so the questions lead to more questions. And you know, and then I look beyond the clouds and I go, why is the sky blue? It's a reflection of the ocean. Okay, so is the ocean blue? No, it's the sun. No, it's not actually blue. So one of them is reflecting the other, and then you, and then I'm thinking, how far out can you see? You know, and you know, it's just constantly thinking about stuff and how everything works and how everything is.
So on the sky thing, in Chinese, they didn't have a word for blue until relatively recent. I mean, they've got a very long history, but the word blue only fell in, you know, a couple of hundred years ago. So there's no concept of blue. The sky was green. It's just another kind of green. And then you have to wonder, like, how many colors are there really? How many names do you have? Like, I'm terrible with this. My color acuity is terrible. I'm technically colorblind. But I used to wonder as a kid, like, if I see something and I go, that's red, you look at it and you say, yes, that's red. We both agree it's red. Mm. But do we actually see the same thing? How could I know what you actually
see? Yeah, I've also wondered that.
Right? And so what you're talking about is this kind of trying to take things apart, trying to understand them, not just by, well, you know, what do the scientists say, or what did they teach me at school, or, okay, now that's good enough. It's like, yeah, but do I really understand?
Mm.
Can I take it apart and put it back together again, and it's still going to make sense type of understand?
And, I mean, you even end up asking ridiculous questions, like, if you just staying on the sky thing, you know, I'm looking up there and I go, but like, is there maybe a dome over that, and is Earth actually flat? Like, do these guys actually have a point? I mean, people believed it for the longest time and only didn't believe it for the last, what, 400 or 500 years.
It seems to be on and off throughout history.
And then it makes me think, and the immediate response is, that's ridiculous, what a clown, why would you even think that? Why wouldn't you think? This is how humanity progresses. You think about stuff and you go, okay, well, okay, then we can show that Earth is round or flat. And I'm not getting into that. I'm just making the philosophical argument that thoughts lead to all sorts of other thoughts, and it can lead to very, very interesting places in your mind. You know, of like, eventually, like, you could end up like David Icke and think that everything's just a simulation. Which is just really an atheist's way of looking at, I guess, God, because a simulation means that there's a simulator of sorts and there's a creator of the simulation. It's the same kind of thing. It's all the same thing. It's just whoever's looking.
Yeah. So I think I want to interject with a little bit of Socrates here.
Yeah.
I'm going to mistell the story terribly, but essentially he got called up by the Oracle of Delphi, nominated and won, you know, wisest man on the planet award for saying, I know that I know nothing.
Mm.
And this idea of admitting right from the start that no matter how much you think you understand or know, you still don't.
Mm.
And what that does is it opens exactly what you talk about.
It's humility.
About. It's intellectual humility, humility, which says, oh, I can keep on asking questions. And that asking questions sort of ties in with free speech and critical thought.
That's correct.
If I decide, well, you know, we have already found consensus on exactly what reality is, and this is how it is, and memorize it, and then you go, oh, okay, that's how reality is. It's like, well, then you're not dynamic anymore.
Mm.
You've accepted a narrative that is static, and that means you're not exploring. And that means you're not questioning yourself, you're not questioning your understanding of the world. And, I mean, there's a certain, when I say ignorance is bliss, perhaps there's a certain kind of bliss to just being in that, accepting a completely static narrative of reality and saying, well, there I am. If you're happy with that, then that can be nice.
But that's the matrix that you're referring to. It's that you wake up having swallowed the blue pill and
you're just completely plugged in.
Yeah. No, yeah. Well, you go to the kitchen and you make your coffee and you climb in your car and you turn on the news, the radio, and you do your thing, and you go home, and you do the same thing over and over and
whatever
over.
Whatever they tell you on the news, that's what reality is. Yeah. That's how, like, you just buy the spin.
That's it, and you don't really ask questions, and then you take the red pill, and you do the same thing the next morning, but then you are looking beyond the cars, and you're wondering, you know, why are you working 9 to 5? Why
is the guy on the news radio saying what he's saying?
Yeah, and why is he saying the same thing as what the other station's saying? Almost word for word, they're saying the same thing, but they're two different stations. Why is that? Oh, maybe they've got, you know, a holding group that is sending out a message. Yeah, and so, that's the Red Pill. That's the Matrix. I mean, the Matrix was a very good movie when it came out. Certainly, you know, sort of hyper-philosophical. I thought the follow-ups were terrible. Matrix 2 and 3 were not very good in my view. But the first one was very, very good. It was more of a documentary in many ways.
Speaking about it last night, actually, and we were saying, like, the sort of big movers in our time, movies in terms of sort of philosophical ones, say that, Fight Club, and we had another one. I can't remember.
But my point is that the term, which you brought it up now, so I just want to quickly approach this. The term conspiracy theory gets thrown around as a pejorative, like as if it's a bad thing to theorize about you know, people conspiring.
And as though there isn't such a thing as people conspiring.
It's so ridiculous. Like, correct. Nobody conspires. Everything is just coincidental and people are just amazing and it's all rainbows and unicorns and bunnies, you know, frolicking through the meadows. You know, JFK, he just happened to be in the way of
a stray bullet
that just was flying through the air, you know. This is the absurdity of throwing around a term like, oh, well, you're just a conspiracy theorist. It literally means to think critically. And by the way, just on that, the term conspiracy theory was actually not coined, but it was weaponized by the CIA. Yeah, in the 1960s. Because of JFK's, yes, because of that assassination. It was an attempt to ridicule people who asked questions. That's all. So let's go back further. Julius Caesar, he just happened to fall on a bunch of knives. You know?
There was a real conspiracy. They conspired. They clearly thought about this before the moment that it happened. It wasn't just a spontaneous glitch in the Matrix.
And let's use the one I'm going to be careful with my words here because I don't want to get this recording censored, so I'll use code words. But there was a certain event that happened in 2020 that just so coincidentally had the same rules around the world, like even the same language, you know, social distancing. Did you ever hear of that term before 2020? Have you ever heard social distancing?
No, look, I mean, I first became aware of you during that time. And as things unfolded, I very quickly realized that there's something authoritarian that is, and exactly what you're saying, it's just the same everywhere.
Well, then,
and
it be coincidental?
But I mean, you remember the early videos coming out of China. These people just spontaneously
falling.
Like just falling dead in the road.
And people believed it.
Like walking and, oh.
And people thought this was real.
Oh, this is what's happening. And then they decided how it should be. Are we going to intubate people? Are we going to do this? Like, this is. And then the whole world just went, okay.
Yeah.
No, wait. And South Africa's like, oh, you're not allowed to buy cigarettes.
Or chicken.
Yeah. Or cooked chicken.
Yeah.
Or alcohol, you know. So everyone's going to stay at home, but they're not allowed to smoke or drink. Like are you trying to drive people insane?
But it was so much more than that.
I mean, it became comical. In a way, it was comical from the start, but it was...
But the language...
It's also so dangerous about that
yes.
Seeing these authoritarians reveal themselves.
But the language also, my friend, the language.
Yes.
So the language is a... So language itself, like epistemological warfare is a big thing. And people don't understand, I think, nearly how severe language influences the way that they see the world. So back then in 2020, there were phrases and terms constantly being used by the media. And whether it's by design or emergence doesn't really matter. The fact is that it starts affecting how people talk, you know, kill granny, whatever, or mask up, you know, or safe and effective. And these terms get used all the time as a way to manipulate. And it leads you down a road of thinking in a way that is not sovereign, and this is the more
pernicious,
this is
dangerous part of this little piece of propaganda.
Well, this is part of the story
it's enslavement.
Yes, but you're talking about now you enjoy the stories of us, of people, and how we tell the stories and how we live the stories. But a lot of people have handed over the agency of their own storytelling, of their own sovereignty, to all sorts of external influences without even realizing it.
And those proxies become,
yes,
whatever those proxies say goes.
Exactly.
And so CNN says the following.
Yes.
Therefore, that is the truth.
And Fox.
Or Fox, yeah. or whatever your pick your poison.
Yeah.
But you're using them as a proxy for your own legitimate searching and critical thinking about things.
And that horseshoes now to the comment I was making earlier about looking up at the clouds and wondering if there's a dome and if Earth is flat. Now, the conclusions might absolutely be absurd and ridiculous, but that's okay, because why should I care if somebody thinks that I'm making a ridiculous conclusion?
And I think it's something that ties in with free speech, and it's incredibly important in terms of Western philosophy. It got us to where we are.
Mm.
And there's a reason why it's critical. If you say, for instance, that the Earth is flat, and I get upset, the question is, why do I get upset?
Exactly right.
Because it means that I have some kind of ideology in my head that is actually fragile, and you're believing something that I don't believe is sort of turning over the apple cart for me. Like, it's shaking my little, and I want to hold on to my ideology.
That's
and,
great.
And you question anything about that, then you're threatening my sense of security in the little la-la land that I've created for myself. That sounds terribly pejorative. Let's stick with it, la-la land.
Yeah.
Because whatever the world is that you've constructed in the narrative that you've constructed in your head, where, like you say, you've handed out to proxies their ability to just plug in and decide things for you, and you're not really questioning anything, it's a fantasy.
Yes.
And therefore it's a la-la land, because it doesn't confront the fact that there are actors in the world who might not have your best interest at heart, and some of those actors might have access to media and channels that you are actually plugged into.
Yes.
And that can influence you and distort the story that you hold in your head and make you unhappy or uninformed, or like the choices you make are based on what you understand of reality. And so if your understanding of reality is a mismatch to actual reality, that puts you in danger.
Yes. And I did a podcast episode recently with a clinical psychologist who was explaining why self-censorship is equally dangerous. Because imagine if everybody started self-centering. Like, there's no top-down influence. It's just people are choosing to censor themselves.
And people have done a lot of this.
It's extremely, extremely dangerous.
Because if you're not allowed to say something, in essence, that means you're not allowed to think it.
Mm.
Now you've got, now you have to become your own thought police. Like, I'm not allowed to say this because people will be upset. So I don't say this and I don't say that, and I'm not allowed to say it. And eventually it's like this precarious little thing of what I'm allowed to say, i.e. what I'm allowed to think. And you're actually enslaved by your inability to move through, yes, the idea space.
And this concept of asking questions, of course, is very old. It goes back to, you mentioned Socrates, goes right back to the Greek thinkers. Hence the Socratic method of finding truth in something by asking questions. And I was mentored by Peter Boghossian, who is a former professor at Portland University in the U.S. He wrote an amazing book with a guy called James Lindsay, and I think it was Helen Pluckrose, or was it just... It was just James Lindsay. I think he did his peer review experiments. Oh, that's right. He did a series of trolling the system with James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose. I was going to
say, throwing around some lovely names here. I'm familiar with some of the stories. Please do continue, though.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, with the false papers, right?
Yes. And so Peter came onto my show, and in fact we become friends. And he has got an amazing ability to extract information in a way that still maintains rapport. I mean, he wrote a book called How to Have Impossible Conversations, and this is kind of what we're talking about here. I mean, talking about Earth being flat is just an example of an
That's
impossible
a great way
conversation.
to start a dinner party.
Yes, and the thing is, I mean, I don't really think Earth is flat, but I certainly appreciate those who arrive at that because it means that they've been thinking, and that is valuable. If you are thinking about whether or not I can make you sick by simply sitting next to you, that's a good place to be. It doesn't matter what your conclusion is. The fact that you're thinking it and you're trying to calculate how contagion works, that's a good place to be. You don't have to go, oh, well, let me just resort to the logical fallacy of appeal to authority. Well, the scientists said this, so therefore it must be.
97% of scientists agree.
Yes, exactly. All right. And that's.
What did the other three say?
Yes. And it was. I don't know if this is correctly attributed to Einstein. I have a feeling it's not, but it's a wonderful sentiment. And if it was, Einstein has said it, great. If it wasn't, someone, whoever said it, great.
Good on them.
But they said that it's. I don't care about 9 out of 10 scientists who agree with one another. I care about that 10th scientist who doesn't agree. That's the way we should be looking at things. It's that 10th scientist,
Yeah,
the
because
1 out of 10.
I mean, consensus is a wonderful thing if we're trying to decide what we should have for dinner, and the majority of people think we should have pizza, and there's one guy who says, "No, I really want pasta." It's like, well, sorry, no, we have a consensus. But when that consensus is trying to understand reality, then you want to consider all the options, and you actually want, exactly what you're saying, that rebel voice. There's a reason. It's always easier for that voice to just agree with everyone else, because when you stick out like a sore thumb, you're going to become sore.
Yes.
Because people are going to either ridicule you or criticize you. And in terms of our human evolution, it makes sense that we don't want to be pushed out of
Yeah,
the group,
it's
right?
herd mentality,
It's
yeah.
a herd mentality. Like, if you don't agree with the people, then maybe you're the enemy. And if you're the enemy, maybe we should just eject you from the tribe. And if you're ejected from the tribe, you're going to die because there's no way to survive by yourself. So better just, whatever you think, just agree. Just go along with the.
So it
So the
was.
guy who sticks out is, it takes bravery. And exactly what you're saying, like you need
Yeah.
to listen to those voices, even if you don't agree with them,
I think it was
especially if you don't agree with them.
Curtis Yarvin. He called it the cathedral, which is, and I think this is kind of loosely attributed to him because I think some people have made adjustments to his argument, but. He essentially argued that the cathedral, quote unquote, would be the establishment, which is made up of government plus media plus academia. And of course, if you go against that, then you're an apostate. And what's funny is that everybody around you will go, oh, yeah, that's me, I'm an apostate, because everybody likes the idea of being a rebel. But then when you actually talk to them, they're not rebels, because the way that they think has been influenced by the establishment. And only when you realize that you have outsourced your agency to think critically, only then can you perhaps regain it and look at the sky or look at the person next to you saying, can that person actually make me sick? Or are we really alone? Or is the religion that I subscribe to actually true? Or whatever. It doesn't. Again, I have to keep saying this. It doesn't matter what the conclusion is. It's the journey that matters.
What you're saying is critical thought is critical thinking is a muscle. And if you don't practice it, it'll atrophy and eventually won't be able to do it.
You need to sharpen the sword.
You need to sharpen the sword. You need to keep on questioning things. You need to really drill down into your understanding of reality and go ask, well, since it's impossible that I have everything right, I must have some things wrong.
Yes.
I know that I know nothing. Which ones are they?
Yeah.
And exactly. How do I... And if I can uncover what they are and I can adjust those, and that brings me closer to actual reality, understanding actual reality a slight bit better, doesn't that bring me closer to the truth? And the truth ultimately sets you free, right? But you can break away from the slavery.
That's true. And then
which might come at a price, but...
It might come at a price, but I also... What I'm saying now, also, I run the risk of being labeled postmodern and relativity, and there's no
relative moral
and I'm not now standing for anything. Of course, that's completely false. I stand for a lot of things because of the nature of thinking critically. I can form a foundational sort of value system on which I make my decisions. You know, I've got a family, you know, and when I wake up in the morning, there are a multitude of values and, of course, by extension, principles that I would apply to my life. And from that, I can determine what I think is right and wrong and what is good and what is not good and all that kind of thing. But when we're talking kind of outside, so that would sort of be your sort of atomic structure. It's the thing that's the closest to you that you've got the most influence over. But once you go beyond that, into the things that you don't really have too much influence over, that's different. I mean, if we're talking about the shape of Earth or contagion or whatever, you don't really have a control. You can't control those. That you can have an assessment of it and you can conclude things. But I have more influence and control over my family and their safety. If you understand what I'm saying, there are levels here. It's nuance. We're dealing with complex systems, and that's another issue that I think a lot of people have, and it's a tribal mentality, and I understand that and I sympathize it because humans are tribal, and I have no issue with tribalism, by the way. I think tribalism, it's part of the herd pack mentality, and it forms bonds and friendships and all sorts of things, and I've got lots of respect and time for tribal thinking, but it is also, it's a double-edged sword. It does lead you to wanting to have binary approaches to everything, which is effectively, you know, false dichotomies, which leads you to one or zero thinking, and everything becomes a zero-sum game. And that's very bad because that is...
Absolutely.
That's in complete violation of complex systems. When you're dealing with complex systems, you have to refrain from absolutism, and you have to allow for critical thinking, holding up a mirror and checking your own analyses.
Yeah. So something I quite like, when you talk about complexity, I think it was on The Dark Horse I first learned about this.
Oh, Brett Weinstein.
Yeah. I quite enjoyed
it. He won't come onto my show.
Oh, at least you tried.
Yeah.
Maybe one day. But this idea of complicatedness versus complexity. And if something is complicated, then it means that you can solve it with a complicated engineering solution.
Yeah, like a bridge.
Yeah. There are lots of things you need to think about. Mm. There are lots of little sums that need to be done and this and that and whatever. But it's perfectly solvable.
Mm. Like if the bridge breaks, you can figure out where it broke and you can strengthen that part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can use a complicated engineering approach to actually solve the problem. When you have something that's complex, you can't come at it with the wrong hammer. You can't try to solve society's challenges with a complicated engineering solution where we're going to have, okay, we've put together 10 million pieces of regulation, we will finally have peace on Earth. It's like, you can't fix complex with complicated solutions. You have to find, and in my experience working with people, working with teams and so on, you need to find some very simple things. And those simple things can just be principles like mutual respect and, you know, whatever they are, to say, if you have these very few things in place, then that can help the complex system. You try to come at it and And I think that that's one of the big challenges we have in society, is that we can see governments all over the world with just burgeoning regulation, just more and more regulation, because the more you try to regulate what's essentially organic, right? Society is organic because it's made up of organic creatures, human beings. And so there's so much dynamicism there. And you just try to keep on regulating, patch it up with more regulation, more regulation. And I think that leads to a lot of pain unnecessarily in this planet.
It's treating the symptoms.
Indeed.
And not looking at the root cause. And so that's been a something that I've been focusing a lot on since starting my podcast, more specifically since that event in 2020. I don't know if we can say it anymore, or if we can, if YouTube's made its policies, but whatever it is, that moment in time, that amplified for me, at least, a lot of new ways of thinking about the world and how everything works.
I think it really, you're talking about Blue Pill and Red Pill. I think it really red pilled a lot of people.
I think so. Yeah, definitely. For sure. 100%.
Not the majority of people on the planet necessarily, but lots of people suddenly start. And some people, it took them longer. I think there are people who look back at it now and sort of sheepishly admit to themselves, I've been on the wrong side of things.
Do you know who Matthias Desmet is?
Name rings a bell.
So I was the second person in the world to interview. And why I make that sound so epic is because he didn't do interviews. He was a professor at the university in Belgium. And when the whole thing happened, he went on to a podcast. And then that guy, that host, contacted me because he knew me, and he said, get Matthias onto your show. But it was one of the most interesting discussions that I've had. And in fact, I had the great pleasure of having lunch with him when I was in Europe, 2023. Amazing guy, Matthias. And he wrote a book on, I think it's called Totalitarianism. I think that's what it's called. And he doesn't necessarily present new ideas, but he's just repackaging ideas in a way that's digestible.
So reminding people.
Yeah, and he makes the argument that at any given point in time, about 30% to 35% perhaps of people will be red-pilled, quote-unquote, okay, or they will be awake, quote-unquote, or they will be, what's another way of looking at it, skeptical of the system or whatever, right, okay, you know what I mean. And that 30% or one-third will always be a problem to the
status quo.
Yes, to the status quo, because they kind of all go, nah. Nah.
It's like, oh, come on, guys, just play the game. Come on, we've set up the rules. Just agree with us.
They're the ones who will see through everything. They're the ones who have swallowed the red pill, so to speak. They are the ones who are awake, so to speak. They are the ones who reject the established narrative, right?
30 to 35%.
Thereabouts. It says one-third, okay, at any given point in history. Which means that if you are at a braai and there are 10 people there, maybe around 7 of them would be normies, as it were. I hate the term normie. I hate these terms, but they are the easiest way to create conversation. Because if I say normie, you know what I mean. But but everybody's normie to some degree, all right? So, like, we aren't...
Still breathe air. Yeah. Still have a beating heart in your chest.
And yeah.
Kind of normal that way.
We just... when I say normie, I mean it more in a comical way. But 7 out of 10 people will most likely believe most kind of established conventional narratives. Right? And about 3 won't. That's what he argues. Now, it's not as simple as that. So of that 7, he would argue that a third of, on from 1 to 10, you'll have the first 30% that would be the red pilled. On the other end, you'll have around 30% also that'll be absolutely completely closed off to the idea of thinking differently. All right, so they will not be ever.
They will fight to defend.
They will not be
the
persuaded.
Lies they believe.
Yeah, they will not be persuaded. And then that remaining chunk that's in the middle that he argues. might or might not be on either side, either or, generally speaking, they would not want to rock the boat. So they would be the majority of people who would just simply put on a mask because that's what they were told to do, but they don't really believe necessarily that it's doing anything, but they also don't want to cause a fight. They don't want families to break apart. They want to still fly to Joburg for business flight or whatever. And he says those people in the middle, many of them will have the potential to increase that initial
30%. Because they could really go either way.
Yeah. But even if it goes up to, say, 50, if that 30% goes up to 50%, it kind of, again, at some point defaults back to that 30%. And it always seems to be around that number.
Interesting.
It's very interesting. So whenever there's a big event, then that will shift. So like during the COVID years, you would have found a lot of people would have gone against sort of the government mandates and all that kind of stuff, right? And that 30%...
Depending on how silly your particular government became.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know anybody who thought that banning cooked chicken was a good idea. So that 30% quickly shot up to, 80, 90%. But now nobody really cares. It's years on, and so we've now forgotten about it, and life has moved on. I guess during World War II, there would have been way more than 30% who were seeing through the whole thing. Whatever, you know, whenever there's a big event, then those balances shift because
I think you use the word not rock the boat for the middle group. They don't generally want to rock the boat, but if the boat is being rocked enough by circumstance,
yes,
then they start to go, well, you know what, actually now I understand it's going to upset some people, but I'm actually going to say what's like, I'll actually take a stand, because they generally don't want to. Because,
and Nassim Taleb writes quite a lot about this. Well, you know, because he writes about risk analysis, and I would strongly
recommend game theory.
Yeah, I'd recommend people read some of his books. They're very readable. They're not difficult, and he had a big influence. Funny enough, he blocked me on Twitter in 2020, and I had never communicated with him. In fact, I loved his work and I promoted it. I've got no idea why he blocked me. But he nevertheless wrote, what was the one that I read now? He's written a few books. I forget the name of it, but it's basically about the risks you take in terms of who you trust and who you put faith in. It's called skin in the game. So those are the ones you actually want to put more faith in. So
because they've got something to lose.
Yes, correct. So, you know, Daily Maverick or News 24 don't have anything ready to lose if they get stories wrong. They just go, oh, sorry, guys.
Yeah, well, and I know a lot of the time they'll put the apology behind a paywall.
Yes, or a little paragraph at the bottom. Doesn't really matter. But let's say it's you or me and we have a tweet or something that goes viral and there's like a million people that look at it. And then it gets found out that what we said is completely false. And that's us gone. Because we'll get absolutely crucified for that, and nobody will trust anything again that we say. So it's imperative that when you make a claim as somebody who's got no real sort of institutional backing, that you say it with as much integrity as possible, because you have skin in the game. But you know that CNN has got no skin in the game. They can say whatever they want, and they'll still keep going. Because
the person saying it, it's not his fault. Mm. His boss told him to. And the boss, no, it's the channel. It's the, like you say, it's not your personal accountability. It's not your personal reputation and your...
So, I mean, I think it's fairly obvious what skin in the game means. And a big part of storytelling, and I'm a big fan of storytelling, and I know that you use the term also. I happen to believe that storytelling is more important than sort of the science or facts or anything like that, because humanity is a result of storytelling. It's passing on things from generation to generation.
So sort of the mimetic evolution of mankind is just story.
Narrative. Yeah, I think so. It's what's created our identity. It's what's created our culture. It's what created, I mean, the science hasn't created any of that. I'm not against the science, by the way, and I'm saying it like that because it's become a it's become a dogmatic thing. Yeah,
there's science, and then there's the science.
TM. Yeah. What I'm saying there, let me just quickly just touch on that. When I say the science, I'm referring to sort of hypermaterialism, and I think life is so much more than just materialism.
Agreed.
You know, there's a lot more going on than just what you see in front of you, or what you think you see in front of you, shall I say. And the story of humanity is exactly that. It's a story. It's many stories. It's millions and hundreds of millions of stories, billions of stories.
Compounded and adjusted and changed over time through human experience, decisions in societies,
correct,
and veer off in different directions.
And stories are not necessarily true, but they are stories nonetheless.
It's sort of the software that we run on, that we see the world through.
Well, I mean, a good example is if you got friends over for a braai for an evening on a Friday night, okay, you don't sit there discussing facts and figures the whole night. You're telling stories, you're telling jokes, you're reminiscing over an incident that happened 7 years ago. You're laughing at how silly people dressed in the 1980s or whatever. It's all storytelling. And it's not necessarily true or not true, because that's not the desired outcome. The desired outcome
that's
is
not the point of it.
The point of it is the connection, the rapport, and the fulfilling nature of that moment. That is the essence of, you know, storytelling on a Friday night around a braai. And because often when you say storytelling, you think, oh well, I'm going to read a book. I'm going to read a book out loud. No, obviously not, because I'm talking about like narratives. And no,
but I think it's because storytelling is associated with something that you do for your little 3-year-old.
Mm.
You're reading from a book, and then, you know, read a little bit of a story before they go to bed, and people don't realize that actually your entire understanding of reality is, as you were saying, it's this compound story. It's all of these stories that you hold in your head, that, and then we have what you're talking about, let's say around the braai fire on a Friday night with some friends. There's certain parts of that story that then you use to actually help build the bonds,
yes,
between human beings. It's actually just about enjoying the presence of other human beings.
Yeah, well, it's about being present. Exactly right. And I mean, my little guy, all that matters to him is experiencing life, and that's creating his story. You know, he'll take my finger and we'll go for a walk, and he is looking around and pointing at things and wanting to walk on the grass and then not walk on the grass and then walk on the grass again. And all of that is just his story. And
exploration.
Yeah. You know, it's not, obviously he's too little to know how anything works, but that already is an indication of how we operate. And I mean, it's very, very sort of deep and profound and all, I suppose. But that, in a long roundabout way, is why I do what I do. It's the exploration of those ideas, of the stories that each person who comes onto my podcast has a story. And it's that story, and it's that set of ideas that person has that I find interesting, and that helps me understand things better. Bruce Lee said something, it's a quote that I use all the time, and I've applied this to my life for years and years and years. He said, take that which is valuable, discard that which is not, create what is uniquely yours. I have found those to be the best words to live by, and that's why I can have a discussion with somebody who thinks Earth is flat or whatever, doesn't really matter what the topic is, because I don't have to dismiss 100% of that person now because I disagree with that idea. Instead, I can engage with that person and listen and take the bits that are valuable and then discard the bits that I think are not valuable. And then I'll create my own conclusion. That's exactly how I am able to then chat to people who are self-described communists or atheists or Muslims or Christians or flat earthers or whatever. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And then realize that I have so much more in common. Because a wonderful tool for division is labeling.
To find ways to separate people.
Yeah, oh, that's a liberal.
Other someone.
Oh, that's a conservative. That's a liberal. Oh, you're right wing. You're far right. I mean, Wikipedia calls me far right. I don't even know what that means.
No, I have no
idea. I don't even know what that means. Like, at what point did right become far? Like, what's that formula? How did you calculate that?
No, they're just ad hominems, really.
It's just ridiculous. Yeah. And when you can dismiss those things and you cut through it and you go, okay, hold on, tell me why you think that. And then you listen to learn, not listen to respond.
And respond and correct or argue. Or it's like, well, I really want to understand.
Mm.
And you're saying sort of Bruce Lee's approach.
Yeah.
Take what you need, discard what you don't, add your own little unique flavor.
Yes. It's profound.
Something that I find quite profound is T.S. Eliot's quote, "The end of all our seeking will be to end where we began and to know the place for the first time."
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good.
And I think that's this sort of the seeking is ultimately seeking the truth. But how do you get to the truth? Well, it's in the word seeking. Like,
yes, and it's asking questions, and it's thinking critically, and it's not self-centering and all those things that we spoke about.
Yeah, it's actively going into the world and trying to see what can I pick up, what can I discard, what can I add my own flair to, and go through the world and have a conversation with people. As I said, like, to me, that's what this podcast is about too.
Mm.
It's about having conversation with different kinds of people. Some people like yourself might be better known, some people are not known at all, but they all have a story. And
it's those ideas that
matter. They're things, they're things in a story, and you can pick up this little piece here and you understand this, and if nothing else, to just appreciate, just be able to appreciate something about someone else. And because ultimately you're saying it's about that othering, and that's how we get set up to fight. And that's how it's easier to control us if we're fighting amongst ourselves. Yes, right?
Exactly right. And
you want a unification of humans by realizing, oh, we're the same kind of organisms, and we come out of the same planet. Here we are. It's a tiny little planet.
Mm.
It's really worth it to learn how to appreciate each other.
But, I mean, without sounding, all woo-woo, it's also just about, if you have a desire to learn, then you automatically will probably have more in common with the person you're talking to than if you're sitting there trying to put them into boxes. So I spent almost a month in China just a few months ago, and I've traveled extensively. I think I've traveled China more extensively now than the average person. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I went literally from Shanghai to Kashgar, and that's from the east of China to the west of China, and Kashgar is on the border of Afghanistan, so it's a heavily militarized zone, and journalists are not allowed there, and it's very, very different to the other side of China, and it's a completely different culture and people and food and everything. In fact, they call it an autonomous zone. That's how different it is. And I know as well as you know that the anti-China sentiment is very pernicious, it's strong, and it's all around us constantly. Those commies, whatever. I went there with the intention of learning. I wanted to wrap my head around why they've been put into a box like this. So massive population, right? 1.5 billion, or if you subscribe to the skeptical argument, closer to 800 million, if you think that they've overinflated the numbers. I don't know what the truth is.
I don't know either.
Shanghai.
I know that I don't know.
Yeah, Shanghai certainly doesn't look intensely populated. Apparently, the population is 30 million, which is half of South Africa in one city. There were loads of areas where I was riding a bicycle where there were no people. But whatever, I don't know what the population is, but let's just assume it's very big. You realize that these terms, communist and totalitarian and whatever, socialist, whatever terms you want to apply, mean nothing, because you're dealing with people. You're dealing with complex systems. You're dealing with culture. You're dealing with religion. You're dealing with so many different variables that applying one word to that many people is utterly insane.
At the same time, and I think where I completely agree with you is that when you meet someone in China, say in Shanghai, you have a beer somewhere and there's a guy and you start chatting to him, he is just another human being.
100% correct.
Right? And there I agree with you. And so for all the people there, that's, you know, how it is. When it comes to government,
that's different.
And here's government of South Africa, America, of Canada, of wherever in the world. Like, invariably, there's power, and we know that power corrupts.
Yeah.
So we know that.
Yeah.
But that's what we've been told. That's what we've been led to believe. And from my experience, that really seems to be true. So
no, it definitely is true.
And so I'm always careful of giving a government a pass because, well, you know, we don't want to be tough on you guys or like this little, because you might have things that you do that are really great as a government, but then there's this little other thing that you do that I don't agree with. And I do, because it's part of free speech and critical thinking, I believe it's important to not let people off, or not let governments off, especially.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. But this is the problem I'm talking about China now, but you can talk about any country, but if you talk about China, I think people tend to also just say the word China, and they somehow merge the state with the people, and everything just becomes one unit, and it's very different. And this is the same as here. I mean, Zimbabwe, if you talk about Zimbabweans, you are talking about the people. You almost always never referring to the government. But if you talk about the Chinese, you somehow include the government into the people. For some weird reason, there's this is a strange merger, which shouldn't be the case. I'm also fairly critical of governments as a whole. I'm more of the sort of Hans Hermann Hoppe school of thinking that, you know, democracy is a ridiculous system. So I, by default, would prefer the Chinese system because there's no voting. And I think voting is a farce. You can't vote harder. You can't vote your way to more prosperity and liberty.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of the benevolent king being the best possible ruler.
And Hans Hermann Hoppe makes that argument that the monarch has got actually more interest in a prosperous country than a president of a democracy or a president of a communist country. Which, by the way, China is not communist. I must just add that. It's not communist. It's severely capitalist. I mean, you make a lot of money there, but it's authoritarian. I think that we must be careful here.
No, I agree with you. I think it's important to break. I was saying, like, I agree with this sort of technocratic way of running a municipality.
Yeah.
Great. Having highly qualified people to make sure that they, yes, I like this. That authoritarian little
but it's piece, not. But just on that quickly.
Because there goes your free speech.
Yeah, I'm slightly more sympathetic to the way they do things there because, A, I don't live there. All right, so it makes no difference to me. I can visit and I can leave. So they do things in the way that obviously seems to work for them, and they've got 5,000-year-old civilization, and they've always been a society of hierarchy. And if you go there, you'll see that it works very effectively. And you always have to hold up a mirror here. This is what's very important here. Because if you say, well, you don't have free speech there, well, where do you?
Fair question.
You don't. Look at what's going on in Europe right now.
No, it's terrible.
People are being arrested for tweets. In the United States, SWAT teams break down people's doors at 5 a.m.
because of something they said on Facebook or X.
Or suspicion of something. The cops in China don't have guns. Unless you're in the militarized zone on the west, which is, that's a bit more complicated. But I mean, generally, they don't have guns, right? They don't break down your door at 5 a.m. What I'm getting at is, again, complex systems. As a political cartoonist or as a podcast host, I have no future in China. So it's a deal breaker. So I'll never go there for that reason. I won't live there. But if I wanted to live there and make a lot of money off technology, yes, good option. If you want to be Joe Rogan, you can't do it in China. But you're better off in the US. I don't even think Joe Rogan could do very well in Europe, for example.
No, I think he'd have trouble.
I think he'd have trouble, yeah. I think the EU is a little bit authoritarian also.
Yeah, it's going through a bit of a phase, isn't it?
That's why I like being...
I'm a little bit concerned.
That's why I like being in Africa, if I'm brutally honest.
Oh, I love being here.
Being in Africa for me is the ultimate, because you have chaotic systems. You have decentralized everything because everything's broken. And there's a sense of freedom in that chaos. You know, you can pretty much do anything here. And you're forced to become quite self-reliant because the system doesn't really care about you.
The system would like to be in any state, but it can't be. So,
And
that sort of forces you to have your freedom.
Yeah, it forces you to also be independent as much as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in like a Chinese society, it's very sort of culturally collective. And there is also a beauty in that. I'm not going to dismiss it. It is a lot of beauty there. I mean, let me just give you a very subtle example of that beauty. When you sit down at a restaurant, your food will arrive in front of you and you'll be spoken to by your first name and then your surname. You know, that's how you'll write it down if they want your table number or whatever, okay? In China, it's your surname first and then your first name. And the reason is, you probably know, it's because it's your family name and family comes first. Now, there's a beauty in that.
There is a beauty in that.
Because if you argue that family is very important and the most important thing, then that is an extension of that. It's wonderful. Your food doesn't arrive in front of you anywhere in China. It arrives in the middle of the table. And then when the food's there, you take from the middle. And there's a beauty in that too, because it's not everybody for themselves. They're always pouring tea in each other's cups and that circular thing in the middle on which the food
sits. Lazy Susan.
Yeah, that thing. And they turn it and you know, and it's a cultural thing and you might go, I don't like that idea. I like the food in front of me. That's also cool. I don't, no issue with that. But I'm just saying, and I mean, I'd like chopsticks. I just cannot do chopsticks. I struggle with that. And
I'm pretty good with those actually.
And I just mess all the time. My point is that there is beauty elsewhere also. It's that Bruce Lee thing. Take that which is valuable, discard that which is not. So there's lots about China, like the authoritarian government I'll discard, but there's also a lot that I'll take value, you know, and then create, you know, my own vibe from that.
I think that's sort of the inspirational message for the day, channeling a little bit of Bruce Lee there.
Mm.
Like, this is why it's worthwhile to go through the world, ask difficult questions, interrogate things, have conversations with people that you don't agree with, stay civilized about it, realize you can always keep learning from them. Take what you do, cast away what you don't, add your own little flair. Yeah. Jeremy, I want to say thank you very much for being on the Dan Dan Flow today. Really appreciated that. Kind of feel like we're just warming up, you know?
Mm. Yeah. It was a great pleasure being here. Really enjoyed it. And I agree with you. I love the in-person vibe. It's amazing. You can chat for so much longer than you can over a screen. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And hope to see you again.
Yes. Soon.